There was no king in Israel. That's a statement that was made to ancient Israel during the time of the judges. And as we think about that statement, what does it mean? There was no king in Israel. And how does that statement apply to you and me today? We're going to examine that statement, there was no king in Israel, and consider it, its context, and the lessons for all of us as Christians here and now. Israel, as you go back in its history, was led by the man of God, Joshua. And under Joshua's leadership, Israel had crossed the Jordan River, and they had conquered the land, much of the land of Palestine. Not all of it. Portions of it were not conquered. But God gave Joshua and the people of Israel success in conquering various portions of the land. And God had promised that he would give them all the land if they would follow him faithfully. And that's where things broke down. As Joshua was coming to the end of his life, he emphasized that he and his house was going to follow God. He was going to continue to follow God to the end. But what were the trends in Israel as his life was coming to a close? What were the trends in Israel as Joshua's life was coming to a close? Let's go back to Judges chapter 2. Judges chapter 2. And let's begin in verse 1. Judges chapter 2, verse 1. Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers, and I said, I will never break my covenant with you. This is Jesus Christ speaking. Jesus Christ is not an angel, but where it says angel there, that can be just be called messenger. Jesus Christ is the Logos. He is the messenger of God. And he was the one who led them out of Egypt. He was the one that was there at Sinai as they entered into the covenant. And he said, I will never break my covenant with you. And God would not break his covenant with Israel, nor will he with us. Israel broke the covenant, and we can break the covenant, but God never will. God will fulfill his end. He says, and you, he told them, he said, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You're not to enter into covenants with the people of Canaan. You're not to enter into covenants with them. You shall tear down their altars. You are to completely reject their religion, and you are to tear down their altars. There's not to be any vestige of their religion left in your land, was what he was telling them. But you have not obeyed my voice. You didn't do what I asked you to do. When I told you to tear down their altars, you've not done that. And he asked them, why have you done this? Verse 3, therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their God shall be a snare to you. Because you've not been held fast to the covenant and not done your part to uphold the covenant, I'm not going to drive the people of Canaan out. They're going to remain among you, and as a result of remaining among you, they are going to continue to worship their gods, and you are going to be challenged to compromise the true religion. They're going to be a thorn in your side. They're going to be a snare to you. Verse 4, so it was when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the children of Israel that the people lifted up their voice and wept because they realized the magnitude of what they were being told here. That they were not going to have a land that was free of the Canaanites, that they had disobeyed God and they were going to suffer the consequences, and they wept. That's why the name of the place was Bochim, which means Bochim, which means weeping. Let's go down to verse 7. It goes on to say here, so the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua. So under Joshua's leadership, they held fast to the truth. Under the leaders who continued on beyond Joshua, they held fast. They stayed pretty much on track. But there were already trends beginning to develop in Israel away from God at the end of Joshua's life. And so they held fast. They served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, those who had come through the wilderness and had crossed the Jordan River with Joshua as they came into the land, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. You know, these were the children who came out of Egypt. They saw the miracles that were done for Israel in Egypt. They experienced manna day by day. They saw the pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day. They saw all of these things. They experienced it all. And they heeded it and they held fast. But there were negative trends that were already unfolding here by the end of Joshua's life. Verse 10. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. The old generation died off. And the new generation that came on did not know God, and they didn't recollect all of the wonderful things that God had done for Israel. You know, we live in a time, as was mentioned in the sermonette last week, we had that, you know, we should look to the elders, and the elders have a lot to offer. There's a certain mindset among the younger, get rid of all the old guys because they don't know what they're doing, they're doddering old fools. And we may dodder, but hopefully we've learned some things along the way, learned some lessons, and learned of God's truth. And we have that truth to impart to you and to all of God's people. And yes, you will take our place, but you have to have the spiritual maturity to do any good. Because you can take our place and have the right to govern, but if you don't have the spiritual maturity to lead God's people, you're going to go the same place as Israel went under the leadership that replaced Joshua and the generation that came after him. You have to have the spiritual maturity to lead. And that's crucial to the success of the people of God. Verse 11. Then the people of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. They served the Baals and they forsook the Lord God of their fathers who brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. And they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtaroths. So they turned from the true God to Baal. And what you have to realize is this was happening to physical Israel, but the problem is no less different for spiritual Israel as it was physical Israel. Spiritual Israel continually, there's a continual battle that goes on in the church to keep the church on track and to keep the church from turning to Baal worship, to adopting the religion of the world. It is a constant battle. You are constantly trying to turn that tide back. And as a minister, it's always seemed like to me that you're like the little Dutch boy who's having the crack in the dike and there's all this water flooding and you stick your finger in there and there's still a lot of water gushing around it and you're only holding a little of it back. And the primary responsibility that a minister has is to try to hold the tide back, to keep the people focused on the truth, holding fast to the truth. I can't do it for you, but you can certainly give it your best shot. That's what John and all of the apostles tried to do. And that's what was happening here. Unfortunately, they were in this trend, this pull is constantly there. And you have to continually be aware of it and seek to turn it back. It says in verse 14, and the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, so he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who despoiled them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. So God did not bless them, and their enemies took advantage of them and overran them. Wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them, and for calamity, as the Lord had said, and as the Lord had sworn to them. And as you think about what we're engaged in militarily at this time as a nation, you can see the same thing unfolding. God is no longer blessing us. God is not blessing us. If God is blessing you, you can have 10 men and they'll defeat 1,000. But when God is not blessing you, you can put 1,000 on the field and 10 will make your soldiers run. God's not blessing us like He was at one time. He says in verse 6, so the people were greatly distressed by all of this. Nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges. So they would sin, they would turn from God, and God would cause them to suffer the consequences of the path that they were following. And then as they became enslaved and suffered those consequences, they would repent, they would cry out to God, and God would intervene. And God would send them a judge, a champion, to lead them. God would send them a judge who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. And I believe that in our time, you know, we've had a champion that has been among us. And a champion isn't going to do it for you, but a champion can rally the people of God and can lead them. Mr. Armstrong was such a person. There's been no one that's come along that has been a champion like that. Mr. Armstrong was a man. He was imperfect, but he did many good things. And we don't have a champion. And will God raise up another champion before it's all over? I don't know. I think we could use one, but I don't know who that's going to be. And even if a champion is raised up, it does not take away the need for you and me to grow spiritually. The champion doesn't do it for you. But the champion can be that person who rallies the people of God, rallies them in keeping the law and keeping the holy days and keeping all of those things that are important to God. And we have to do it, but they can rally God's people. And we don't have such a champion at this time. And I've thought it would be nice to have such a person, but I don't know who that's going to be. So the judges came and they delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. And you know, as you look at the story of the judges, you know, we've talked about Jephthah. He wasn't perfect. What about the guy with Samson? Was he perfect? He was a man of faith, but he was imperfect. But he did rally the people of God. Yet they would not listen to their judges. But they played the harlot with other gods and bowed down to them. They turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked. In obeying the commandments of the Lord, they did not do so. And when the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. And then when their judge would die, what happened? They would revert right back to what they were involved in before. And as you look at the great kings that ruled in Israel or Judah, as the people would turn to God, but as soon as that king would die, they would go right back to where they came from. And that is the trend among the people of God, and has been. It's a trend of sin, servitude, supplication, and salvation. That's a trend that's played out among God's people nationally, among spiritual Israel, and it plays itself out, it seems, in our individual lives as well. So as we examine the history of Israel and the church, this pattern or cycle is something that we find with some regularity. But let's go on and let's focus on the last last chapters of the book of Judges, Judges chapters 17 through 21. Chapter 17 through chapter 21. And what's interesting is you look at these chapters, they are out of sequence. As you look at the time element in these particular chapters, you find that really they should be at the beginning. They're taking place at the beginning of the book. Now you may be saying, well, is that a mistake? It's not a mistake. They were put in that order for a specific reason. But as far as time sequence, they were written probably at the end of Joshua's life and the beginning of the period of the judges. That's really when they're unfolding. Here's why. There are four reasons why that's the case. The first of those reasons is found in Judges 18, verses 1 through 3. Judges 18, verses 1 through 3. And we'll just go back there and read through that quickly, so that you can understand where we're coming from here. Judges 18, verses 1 through 3. It says, in those days there was no king in Israel. And in those days the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself. So they were seeking an inheritance and they didn't have enough room for everybody. They needed more territory. For until that day, their inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them. So they're still becoming established in the land. That's at the beginning of things, not at the end of the period of Judges. So the children of Dan sent 5 men of their family from their territory, men of valor from Zorah and Eshtaol, and to spy out the land and search it. They said to them, "Go search the land." So they went to the mountains of Ephraim. So they come to the land of Ephraim, the territory of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. While they were at the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of a young Levite. And so they're establishing themselves in the land. And as you go back to Joshua chapter 19, verse 47, it talks about them going up and conquering a place called Laish, L-A-I-S-H. In that particular verse, it's called Leshem, but it's the same place. And the settlement of Dan's territory must have taken some time. And so the conquest of Laish must be put either late in Joshua's time or very early in the period of the judges, because the tribe of Dan is just being established in their territory. A second reason why this seems to be occurring early on has to do with the verse, chapter 18, verse 30. Chapter 18, verse 30. It says, "Then the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land." Now, what's interesting about this here, it says that it talks about Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh. What's interesting is the way that's written in the Hebrew. The way it's written in the Hebrew is not the way it was originally written. What they've done is the Masoretes, who were scholars who wrote the New Testament or the Old Testament and wrote it down, and they put all the vowel points in, the jots and tittles and all of that kind of thing. They put all of that in there to help with pronunciation and to preserve it. Those individuals put the N in there, the nun, the letter nun. And it's thought that they put it in there because if you leave that letter out, it says M-S-H. Moshe. If you look in your margins, it may actually say that. Moshe. So as you think, and one of the sons of Moses, his name was Gershom. And so it's thought that this is a reference to the grandson of Moses, Jonathan, the son of Gershom. And unfortunately, he was an apostate. Just because you're the son of somebody that's renowned doesn't mean you're going to be faithful. And so it's thought that they may have inserted that in there in order to try to not have Moses in any way disparaged. But facts are facts. So that's a possibility, because we note something else here. The third reason why this was probably written at that particular time. All of this has a point, as we understand that this was probably written at the beginning of things, as we'll see here. In Judges chapter 20, verse 1. Let's go there. Judges chapter 20, verse 1. It says, So all the children of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, as well as from the land of Gilead, and the congregation gathered together as one man before the Lord at Mizpah. And then let's go down to verses 27 and 28. So they're gathering here at this particular place. Verse 27, "So the children of Israel inquired of the Lord. The Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it in those days, saying, 'Shall I yet go out to battle against the children of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease?'" So here we have the high priest at this time is Phinehas. He's the grandson of Aaron. So if you think about this, he's the grandson of Aaron. And so you have the grandson of Moses, who has adopted a way that is against God, going away from God. And Phinehas is the high priest and serving. And he was a high priest early on in the period of the judges, at the time when Joshua was still alive and Israel was entering the period of the judges. And so Phinehas was old enough to have survived into the period of Joshua and perhaps the early part of the period of Judges, and this would put the war against the Benjamites at the end of at the beginning of the period of the Judges, not at the end. The fourth reason is this. The war against the Benjamites was so devastating to Benjamin that it was feared that the tribe would be wiped out. Once the war unfolded, there were only 6,000 Benjamites left. 600 men left. And there were no women left of the tribe of Benjamin. So it was in jeopardy of dying out. And so only 600 left. And no women for wives. Yet at the division of the kingdom under Rehoboam, at the end of Solomon's reign, Rehoboam, his son, began to reign. And as the war was unfolding between Israel and Judah, an army of 180,000 was gathered, and Benjamin was a part of that. They had a portion of their tribe that was part of that fighting force. If the story of the war against Benjamin is correctly placed in the chronology of the book of Judges, that would mean, that is at the end, that would mean there's only about a 120-year period to go from 600,000 to a large enough tribe to contribute the number of people that they did. So it makes more sense that it would be at the beginning of the period of Judges, which gives them about 400 years in which to reconstitute the tribe and to have plenty of men to be able to contribute to the force. So as you look at this, the history of these actions has not been placed in a chronological sequence, but these last chapters, 17 through 21, are out of sequence with the rest of the book of Judges. So the question is this a mistake? Much as you look at the Bible, there are various portions of it that are not in chronological order. And these accounts were added to Judges intentionally and purposefully, and it's instructive to search out why they were placed here. There was a reason for it. As one Bible study study Bible notes, there is a certain logic to placing them at the end of the book. The structure highlights the theme of the disintegration of Israel. It highlights the theme of the disintegration of Israel. And the reason for this disintegration will be found as we examine the last few chapters of Judges. Let's go to Judges chapter 17, and we'll look at things in more detail here and understand why Israel was on a course of disintegration. Let's begin in chapter 17, verse 1. It says, "Now there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah." So we have an Ephraimite, and Micah was his name. "And he said to his mother, 'The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you, and on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears, here is the silver with me, I took it.'" So he had 1,100, his mother had 1,100 shekels of silver, and he stole the 1,100 shekels of silver. And she pronounced a curse on whoever took it. And it seems that out of fear of that curse coming true, he decided to admit that he had taken it and return it to his mother. And his mother said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my son." So when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, "I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you." Do you note any problem there? Verse 4. "Thus he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith. And he made it into a carved image and a molded image. And they were in the house of Micah. The man Micah had a shrine." Is there a problem with that? "And made an ephod." Is there a problem with that? "And household idols." Any problem with that? "And he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest." So all of this takes place. And let's go down to verse 12. It says, "So Micah so eventually he finds a Levite here that will serve as his priest. And he signs him up to serve in his shrine. So Micah consecrated the Levite in verse 12. And the young man became his priest and lived in his house, lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me since I have a Levite as priest." Is that true? I have a Levite as my priest. Now God is going to bless me. That was his thinking anyway. So the chapter begins with Micah the Ephraimite stealing and eventually returning the shekels that he had stolen from his mom, and then she says, well, they're dedicated to build this altar and this shrine, and they go about doing that. Some interesting things about this is that as this is all unfolding, what you're seeing described here, their intention is not to rebel against God. That's not their intention. Micah's mother invoked the name of God in blessing her son. "May you be blessed by the Lord, my son," she says in verse 2. And she had originally dedicated the silver to God, as it says in verse 3. And what was the name of her son? Micah, which means "who is like the Eternal." And consider the shrine. It says shrine there, but if you look at the words in the Hebrew, it's Beth Elohim, which means house of God. And we know one of God's names is Elohim. And so it says house of gods, it could be house of God, and this might have been a representation of the tabernacle that was being set up there, the God's tabernacle. Micah also has an ephod. Who wore an ephod? The priest. The priest wore a linen ephod as they served in the tabernacle and the temple. Verse 5 also mentions his teraphim, or household gods, which were small figures representing God. Or they may have been some other device associated with the God, maybe even a miniature Ark of the Covenant. So this man was pleased to hire the Levite as his priest, at least showing he had some respect for the God who had appointed the Levites to religious service. And he sought instruction from the priest. He called him father. Which being a term for one who teaches and provides counsel. And Micah, as we saw, believed God would bless him. You know, this whole rationale is like, okay, we can, as long as we designate a particular time as people as holy, then God will accept that and be perfectly happy with it. We're doing it in God's honor, so it's all okay. Our intention is good. So as we see here, while not wholly in line with God's instructions, neither was this meant to be a wholesale apostasy. What it was the worship of God united to idolatry. The technical term for that is syncretism, which is a blending of the truth with paganism or false teaching. And God says expressly, don't do that. You might keep your finger in Judges and turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 29. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 29. Here it says, "When the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land." So as God brings you into the land, he gives you the land of promise, then, and you're going to begin displacing them, what should you do? He says, "Take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods." You know, we don't inquire after them. We don't seek their gods. We may seek to understand how they worship simply for the purpose of sometimes questions come up about other religions and other points of view, but you don't pursue it. You don't pursue it. You don't adopt it as your religion or blend it with the true religion. He says, so you don't inquire after their gods, saying, "How do these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise." You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. For every abomination to the Lord which he hates, they have done to their gods, for they burn even their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. As you adopt their ways and you adopt their gods, you will go down their same, you're following the same path. And you'll end up at the same place they did. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. As far as your religion is concerned, look in the Bible, understand what the Bible teaches you, and follow it. You shall not add to it, and you shall not take away from it. The Apostle John also emphasized that at the end of the book of Revelation. So a blending of the true and the pagan was the path Israel followed here and throughout her history. And the Church of God has done the same throughout its history. So what's the follow-up verse in Judges chapter 17? So he goes through and explains what Micah was doing, and what does he say in verse 6? In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Adam Clark makes this comment about the section of the verse, every man did which was right in his own eyes. He was, speaking of Micah, he says, he was his own governor. And what he did was right, and by his cunning and strength defended his conduct. When a man's own will and desire are to be made the rule of law, society is in a most perilous and ruinous state. I thought that was worth noting. When a man's own will and desire are to be made the rule of law, society is in a most perilous and ruinous state. We are in that state as you look around you today. Doing what seemed right rather than following God's explicit commands is a recipe for disaster. As it tells you in Proverbs 14, verse 12, it says, there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof is death. It may seem right, but it ends up bringing about suffering and destruction and ultimately death. Though not intended to be apostasy and rebellion against God, it was apostasy and rebellion. And sincerely attempting to please God is no excuse for breaking His direct commands. Well, God doesn't mind. God doesn't care. Really? I'd be careful with that. We all have to remember these things in our worship of God. Why did every man do what was right in his own eyes? Why was that the course that they were following? The reason was there was no king in Israel. There was no king in Israel. So if you're looking at Israel at the time, there is no physical king there. There is no physical king. There were judges, but there weren't judges all the time. But periodically they were raised up in different sections of the territory of Israel, and there wasn't a judge who ruled all of Israel at any time. There were judges that were raised up in different sections of the territory. So would it have mattered if there was a physical king? Would they have done any better? Look at Israel's history once the kingship was established. Look at the evil kings who led the people of Israel astray. A better question should be, should there have been a king in Israel? Physically, there was no king. But as you step back and you think about it, was there a king in Israel? Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 12, verse 12. 1 Samuel chapter 12, verse 12. Keep your finger in Judges, but we'll look at 1 Samuel 12. 1 Samuel 12, verse 12. It says, and when you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us when the Lord your God was your king. See, Israel's king was God. But they rejected him as king. They wanted a physical king. But they had stopped and thought about it in the time of the judges, God was their king. Unfortunately, their condition was they didn't accept God as their king. And they suffered the consequence by going astray. God was their king. He was to be. And all of the judges and all Moses was basically a viceroy, a vice king. Joshua was a vice king. God was their king. And the man, the physical individual who ruled Israel, was a vice king in that sense. The judges were champions. They served God. God was to be the king. And that champion was to point them to God, because that's really the solution to their problem. Let's go to chapter 18, verse 1. It says here in verse 1, "In those days there was no king in Israel." Same statement. And as these statements are made, it leads on to discuss another part of the decline. It says, "And in those days the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance." So it goes on to talk about this. And there was no king in Israel. And then let's go to the end of chapter 18. Dan is seeking their own territory, and they come upon Micah and his shrine and this Levitical priest. And what do they do? What do they do? Let's go to verses 30 and 31. "Then the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image that they took from Micah. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, or more accurately Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh." So basically, once they came to Micah's house and saw the setup there, later on, they came back and said, "We're going to take your shrine, we're going to take your gods, we're going to take your priest." And basically they said, "You going to do anything about it?" "Oh, no. Well, we're good. Goodbye." And he took everything. Remember that Micah said, "Well, God will bless me." In the end, he didn't have anything, did he? So let's go to chapter 19 now. Chapter 19. So we've looked at some trends here, and this continues the trend. Chapter 19 begins in the same way that chapter 18 did. "And it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel." And it talks about this Levite who is traveling, had a concubine. And his concubine left him for whatever reason and went back home to Bethlehem. So the Levite allowed this to pass for a while, and then after a few months he went down to Bethlehem to recover his concubine. So he came there and found his concubine, and she introduced him to her father, and they settled everything, and she agreed to go back to the mountains of Ephraim with him. So they set out on their journey, where they were getting ready to set out on the journey, and it goes through all this delay in their leaving and all of that. So finally, the Levite said, we're leaving, and I don't care if it is late in the afternoon, we're leaving. So they set out on their journey, and they made it to the city of Jebus, which is now Jerusalem. They made it to that point, and the servant said, "Well, why don't we stay with stay here in the city of Jebus?" And he said, "We're not staying with those Gentiles, and so we're going on to Gibeah or Ramah, and we'll stay with our people of our Israelitish background." So they went on, and they arrived in Gibeah. And so they got there toward evening, and there was no place to stay, and they were just going to sleep in the square. And this man who happened to be from the mountains of Ephraim notices him, and he said, "What are you doing here?" And they exchange where they're from and all of that. And he explains, "Well, I've looked for some place to stay, but nobody has offered me hospitality." And they said, "Well, absolutely don't sleep in the square. That's not going to go well for you. So come and stay with me." So he does. He comes and stays with the man that's also from the mountains of Ephraim. And what happens is people of the town notice that there's somebody staying with this man that's a stranger. And they come up and they want to know the priest carnally. And so the host, that welcomed him in, this older man, goes out and says, "Don't do this. You can't do this. I've offered him hospitality, and this is a great atrocity that you're committing to do something like that. Take my daughter and the Levite's concubine instead." And eventually, the way it worked out, they let the concubine went out there, and she suffered gang rape and died. And so you come to the morning, and the Levite begins, gets up, and he's leaving, and he says, "Get up, let's go." And, I mean, the way it's written, there's absolutely no compassion on his part. No wonder she left him in the first place. But anyway, there's no compassion, no interest, but he knows she's dead. So he's angry because of this, and he loads her body up, and he takes it back home, and he cuts it into 12 pieces and sends it out to the tribes of Israel. And he said, "We need to, an atrocity has been committed here, and we need to take care of this." A couple of reasons why this might have been is because this was a violation of a basic facet of life, which was if hospitality could not be violated. And they were inhospitable. They did not treat a guest properly. And life in the Middle East had always been difficult. And to cope with all of the arduous difficulties of traveling, an elaborate system of social customs was set up. And it was a serious thing to violate these customs. And if they violated them, then offense could be taken and action could be taken. It could, in fact, ignite conflict between a clan or a tribe. And that's one factor. The other factor is, what does this sound like? What takes place here? What does it sound like? What earlier story is it similar to? It's similar to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Very similar to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. So not only from the Pentateuch, but even, people were familiar with this story, not only from the writings of Moses, but also from stories that had probably been passed down through generations that were aware of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. So the abominable behavior of the inhabitants of these cities and others around them was a major factor in the cry that went up to God against them. And the destruction of Sodom and her neighbors was so complete that even even today, their exact whereabouts are unknown. And the parallels are pretty striking in that this mob, the group of men come up and make these demands, and the older man comes out like Lot did, and then what took place after that. So this was a serious problem that ignited a war in Israel. And as you think about these men, you look at the Levite, he was a representative of God. And yet, he did not, the way he acted was, not very godly, surrendering his concubine to be abused. And look at the man, he offered his daughter to be abused as well. So we see the low status of women, and it tells you the status of that society. And it's an appalling story all the way around. And it illustrates how low things had sunk to the depravity level of Sodom and Gomorrah. And the prophet Hosea actually makes note of this. He cites Gibeah and the terrible atrocities that took place there in Hosea chapter 9, verse 9. So with the clash between the two armies looming, the Israelites obtained counsel from God. And what did God tell them? Go up. Go up and fight against Benjamin. They did. And the first few times they went out against Benjamin, they were defeated. 40,000 Israelites died, and virtually no Benjamites died. And the question, we don't know exactly why God did not bless them. God did not bless them at the beginning. Perhaps God was not pleased with the way they were going at this point. We do know that as they failed to defeat the Benjamites, what did they do? They fasted and they sacrificed to God, which was something quite rare in this period, and God may have wanted them to come to this point. And the Israelites finally succeeded in defeating Benjamin. They used a tactic that they had used at Ai, where they drew, they attacked, and then they turned and fled, and the people of the town of Ai came out after them, and Israel turned on them and had laid a trap for them, and they defeated them. The same thing took place here. And as the Benjamites were defeated, there were 600 men left. 600 men left who went to the town of Reman there was a stronghold there. They took refuge there and maintained themselves during a four-month period. And what did the tribes of Israel do during that four-month period? Well, they had defeated the Benjamites, but during those 4 months, the Israelites did something as bad as the crime that had been committed in Gibeah. They went through Benjamin's territory and they slaughtered the entire tribe, all of the remaining men and women and children, young and old. And there was no justification for this. The Israelites may have felt it was just because some of these cities had contributed men to fight against them. But from God's perspective, was that what they should have done? The slaughter of all the Benjamites except 600 men holed up in Rimmon only worsened the situation. And now they faced an entire tribe that might be wiped out. There were no women for the men of Benjamin to draw from, and no one in Israel would give their daughters. They had basically taken an oath. We're not giving our daughters to these men. We won't do it. So what could be done? Well, while searching for an answer, the men of Israel determined that no men had come up to war from Jabesh-Gilead. Oh, they had not contributed any to the army of Israel. So they said, well, we'll go down there and wipe them out. So they killed all the men. And they killed all the married women, but they preserved the virgins. Only 400 virgins were left from that city, so that's you still need 200 women to marry the men of Benjamin. So they couldn't give them any of their daughters because of the oath that they had taken. And so, hey, here's a solution. And we'll allow them to take some of our women and as wives. And so we'll let them take them and we won't dispute it. We won't go after them or any of that. So they allowed all of this to take place in order that they could reconstitute the tribe. And you can see their logic is twisted. So basically they had taken an oath and and it's all twisted logic to get around it. And you can see as you start down that path of doing your own thing, whatever you feel is right, that's where you get into some serious trouble. So what should the Israelites have done? How should they have resolved this? Well, they should have, the first thing, following through on the intent of their oaths would have put them in an untenable position from their vantage point. So they had a problem, so what should they do? The first thing they should have done was repent of their foolish vow. Repented of the foolish vows that they had made. Secondly, they should have gone to Phinehas, the high priest, and inquired of God about what to do. Well, God, we've made these foolish vows. What is the best solution here? They never did that. And God could have explained to them what they should do. You know, the Bible gives you instruction that you could void, as a father, a daughter's vow. And as a husband, you could void your wife's vow. And since Israel was God's daughter by creation and wife by covenant, then God could have voided their vow. And also, we have to keep in mind as we make vows that no vow is binding if it obligates one to violate God's commands. So the real solution was humble repentance, something sorely lacking in that time, because everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So as it says in Judges 21, verse 25, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So there are some things that we need to consider here as we come to a conclusion. Three things that we need to consider. And these are three things that are foundational to a society. The first of those is the home. The second is human government. And thirdly, the system of worship. All of these are important to a human society. And what we find in the time of the judges is confusion in the home. As you read through chapter 17 and the worship that was set up there in that particular home, especially chapter 17 verses 1 through 6, you see that there is confusion in that home. And it's illustrative of the condition in Israel. First is the home because it is the basis of the society. Isn't that where God began? He created man. He created woman. And he said that they were to be joined together as one to form a family. And as Psalm 11 verse 3, it tells us when the foundations are destroyed, you're in real trouble. And this is a foundational part of society. When that foundation crumbles, society begins to fall apart. And look at our society today. Look at the number of out of wedlock births. Look at the number of families where there's just one person in the family. That person has to work. How much time do the children get? I was reading a book called Coming Apart, and it's interesting as you look at it, and it's talking about the way life was on November 23rd, I believe it is, 21st or 23rd, 1963. Maybe November 21st. Does anybody know what happened on November 21st, 1963? What? Who? Kennedy? Yeah. 22nd? Anyway, it's close. So I think that's what it was. I was guessing. But it's 1963 in November. And I remember when President Kennedy was killed, I remember what I was doing when I heard of what had happened. But anyway, he talked about the way life was then. 80% of women were in the home. They weren't working. Out of wedlock births were like 1.5%. And it was a different world. And our world has changed remarkably and not for the better. And this is what was happening in Israel. It was a confused home that was common in Israel. What we see with Micah, his mother and their household, is a family that is spiritually and morally confused. They managed to break almost all of the Ten Commandments. And yet they didn't feel the least bit of guilt before God. In fact, that's that they thought they were serving God. As you think about that, the son didn't honor his mother. Instead, he stole from her and then lied about it. And first he coveted the silver and then he took it, which, you know, coveting is idolatry. Then he lied about the whole enterprise until the curse scared him into confessing. And so he broke the 5th, 8th, 9th, and 10th commandments. And he broke the 1st and 2nd commandments by having a shrine of false gods in his home. So he broke 7 of the 10, you know, if you're keeping score. The man's mother broke the first 2 commandments by making an idol and encouraging her son to maintain a private shrine. And really there was no call to make a shrine. God said, "My place of worship is the tabernacle," which was in Shiloh, and then the temple in Jerusalem. You weren't to have private shrines. You could worship God in spirit and in truth. And then Micah not only had a private shrine, but he ordained his own son to serve as priest. And didn't Micah know that God had his priest, had appointed the family of Aaron to be priest? And for anyone to become a priest or to say he was a priest, what was their fate in Israel? They were to be killed. They were to be killed. Because Micah and his family didn't submit to the authority of God's word, their home was a place of religious and moral confusion. But their home was a good deal like many homes in our world today, where they are confused. Godly homes are the foundation for a just and happy society. The second area of confusion is in the ministry, which is talked about in Judges chapter 17, verses 7 through 13. Not only did God establish the home and instruct parents how to raise their children, as he talks about in Deuteronomy chapter 6, he also instituted spiritual leadership in his community. Under the old covenant, the tabernacle and the temple were the center of the community, and the Aaronic priesthood supervised both. And under the new covenant, the church is the temple of God, and you have a ministry that is to serve God and his people. The Levite named Jonathan had been living in Bethlehem of Judah, which was not one of the cities that was assigned to the priest. So why was he in Bethlehem of Judah? Could it be because Israel had not been supporting the priesthood? So if you're going to be a priest, you do need support. There was no support, so he said, "Well, I've got to go someplace and get a job." So he went to Bethlehem in Judah and found a way to support himself there. And as you look at the decline of Israel and you look at the decline of the church, when people cease tithing, you can tell it's going downhill. It's a fundamental aspect of being God's people. And so when God's people grow indifferent to spiritual things, one of the first evidences is a decline in their giving to the work of God. And as a result, everybody suffers. So instead of seeking a godly solution, Jonathan set out to find a place to live and work, even if it meant abandoning his calling. In other words, he did what was right in his own eyes. And the nation was at a low ebb spiritually. By doing what was pleasing to God, he could have helped point the people in the right direction. That's why you have to hold fast to the truth even when it's hard. Even when people may not be supporting you financially, you have to do your part to try to make it work. Paul did that. As the church did not support him in Corinth, he supported himself. He says, instead of being available to God, Jonathan was agreeable only to men, and eventually found himself a good job with Micah. And as you think about Jonathan, this priest, he was actually a hireling. So he was happy to work for Micah, and Micah's paying him, and he's got a good deal there. And then here come the Danites, and they say, hey, we're going to take his gods, we're going to take his shrine, we're going to take everything, and if you want to come, we'll take you too. And guess what? If you work for us, you get a whole tribe, not just this one household. You're going to get more money, more prestige, and all of that. And he said, sounds like a good deal to me. And off he went. Off he went. Is that the kind of ministry we want? Is that the kind of ministry that Israel needed? And that's typical of the ministry of the time. And that's why Israel was in the condition it was in. The sad part of the story is that when Micah set up his religious shrine and had a Levitical priest oversee it, he thought he had God's favor. And when it all came to pass, he had nothing left. The third point here is confusion in society, which is talked about in Judges 18. As we've said, God should have been the king in Israel, and his word, the law, should have been governing society. But people were doing their own thing. And if the people had forsaken their idols, and if the elders of Israel had consulted God's law and obeyed it for God's glory, Israel could have been governed successfully. Instead, what do we find? Everyone was doing what was right in his own eyes. And as a result, the society was filled with sin and confusion. Think about our world today. It's very similar. The account of Micah, Jonathan, the Danites, the Levite, and the concubine, and the atrocities that followed is more than just ancient history. It's a revelation to all of us about the wickedness of the human heart and the hopelessness of human society apart from God. And as you think about our nation, we've rejected God, and we draw further and further away from Him. What we see in the final chapters of the book of Judges provides lessons that apply to us now. Lessons that apply in our homes. Lessons that apply in our religious foundation. Lessons that apply in the society that is disintegrating before us. And we understand that true religion is crucial to all of us, and true religion is crucial to our nation and all of our lives, and we must not do what is right in our own eyes. And that's the trend in the world. That's been the trend in the church. I don't know how many times over the years since United started, I've heard, well, nobody's going to tell me what to do. Heard that a lot. Nobody is going to tell me what to do. And every time I hear that, I always think, now you're saying that, but what happens when you're supposedly in God's kingdom? You don't think Christ is going to tell you what to do? You're not going to learn it in the kingdom. You're either going to learn it now or you're not going to learn it later. This is the time. You're either going to do what God tells you or you're not. We're not going to be, well, I made it in the kingdom and I was as stubborn as a mule. Sorry. You're going to end up where mules end up, I guess, and not be a part of God's kingdom. So we can't do what's right in our own eyes. We would want to do what God wants us to do. So God was the king that was missing in Judges chapter 17 through 21. And the question is, will we submit or do what is right in our own eyes? Is there a king in Israel? Is there a king in Israel? That will be the question that will be answered in the coming years in our nation and in the church. And it is a question that we will examine more fully next week.